Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In podcast number 38. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'll be looking at a kind of haphazard history of Australian science fiction cinema. There's not terribly large amounts of it, but there are some things you might have missed, so I thought I'd talk around that a little bit. I'm also going to update people on the Patreon campaign to fund the podcast, and let you know that next time around it's going to be a very interesting Martian Drive-In podcast, because I made a bet with some people and I lost. So I'll get on with the show after the contact details. Sit back and relax. The Martian Drive-In podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is, it could be all the way from Georges Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. Hey, how's it going, Drive-In Martians? Yes, things here have been a lot of fun. As I mentioned last time, the Patreon campaign to get a little bit of funding for the podcast from you, the listeners, has gone on apace. And I had a bit of a brainstorm about a week ago, which made things very weird and interesting, and it's going to affect the next Martian Drive-In podcast in a way I can't predict the outcome of. So what I did was, I was sitting at work and I had a few minutes to spare, and I put up this idea that if I got a certain number of donors, I would review the first three Star Wars movies on the Martian Drive-In podcast. Now, as everybody who's listened to the podcast knows, I hate Star Wars. I think it's dumbed down and ruined science fiction for a very long time. It's had more of a negative effect than a positive one on the genre. But I thought, I've got to kind of put my mouth where my opinions are and revisit the three movies and review them for the podcast. And the only way I was going to do that is if I got something back for it. In this case, it's a little bit of funny. So what happened was, a friend of mine called Jane decided that she was going to throw the money, all of the money that I required to do this, at the Patreon fund, which she's done. She threw a ton of cash at me and said, ha ha, now you have to do it. So thank you, Jane. So what's going to happen in the next Martian Drive-In podcast, almost against my will, is I'm going to watch and review all three of the first Star Wars movies on this podcast. My friend Shane, who actually started Star Walking, the Star Wars Club in Australia, is looking forward to this. He actually wants me to write a bit about why I don't like Star Wars for the Star Walking newsletter, which I'm going to do. But he's really looking forward to this, because he doesn't mind a dissenting opinion. He's the only person I know that's actually been to Skywalker Ranch and seen the museum and done all that kind of shit. Shane's a lovely guy, even though he does kind of build a certain aspect of his life around a really shit movie. So that's what's going to happen next time around, is Star Wars is going to get the Martian Drive-In touch, and I'm not sure what's going to happen with that. I'm going to revisit it. I'm going to, if required, do a hatchet job on it, but one way or the other, I'm going to fulfill the obligation that I made to you, the listeners, through the Patreon campaign, to give Star Wars a go. Now, this is could end up a dog's breakfast. It could end up being a lot of fun, but one way or the other, I'm going to do it. And that's a nice thing about the Patreon campaign. It can take me out of my comfort zone. I've got some people who have contributed for the Paleo Cinema side of things, who are now suggesting movies, because one of the things you can get for donating a subscription to the podcast is you can suggest movies for the podcast and I will review them. And I've got a couple of movies that I didn't even know about that were totally off my radar, which I'm now going to be reviewing. So there you go. It's taken me out of my comfort zone. The biggest reward I've actually got for this isn't the money part. The money part just pays for podcast hosting and things like that. The biggest reward is A, engaging with people, and B, getting those suggestions that take me out of that comfort zone and take me to places that I might not have gone before with the podcasts. So for me, that's the bonus. I don't, and to be honest with you, it lets me be a little bit lazier because I don't have to think of the movies to see and to talk about in the podcast. So there is that, and I don't mind that at all. And also, I get the very, very useful feedback on what kind of movies do the audience want to see me do. And I do like that part as well. As you know, we haven't been getting a lot of feedback for the podcast, and yes, it's all your fault. But in this sense, I'm getting some feedback, and I'm getting a better sense of what the people who are listening to the podcast want to see as a part of the podcast or hear as a part of the podcast more correctly. So that's happening, and it's kind of exciting. It's a little bit scary as well, but I'm going there, and I'm going to be confronting the gorilla in the room on the next Martian Drive-In podcast. And I've got to thank my friend Matt at work for lending me the DVDs for the movies as well. That way I don't have to pay out any money for them. But Matt's lending me all three of the original Star Wars movies. Yes, they've got all the rejig stuff, and I'm going to be addressing that in the podcast as well. Who knows what's going to happen with that. But one way or the other, Star Wars will be talked about in the next Martian Drive-In podcast. So, what have I been watching in the realm of genre stuff? I did do a big download of a TV series from 20 years ago, or 21 years ago, called Time Tracks, which is about a guy from the future who comes back to capture and send back to the future criminals who have come back in time to escape prosecution. It's an interesting series in a couple of ways, one of which is it was an American series which was filmed in Brisbane in Australia, and so you get that kind of cross-pollination of a lot of Australian actors, a lot of Australian scenery, a lot of Australian places, and American stars and things like that. So it's kind of makes a weird universe in a sense for the particular thing. Stars an actor called Dale Midkiff, who's a jobbing actor, as many of them are, and an Australian actor called Elizabeth Alexander playing his kind of computer hologram sidekick. And yeah, it's not too bad. I'm kind of watching a few episodes and enjoying it, and kind of comparing how 20 odd years ago the complexity of storylines isn't as intense as it is nowadays, and that they don't have that series-wide arc of a story as much. They're very much discrete episodes in this series, even though there is the overwhelming arc of him chasing down these criminals and sending them back to the future with a little zappy thing in a car alarm. But, yeah, it's not bad, and I'm kind of enjoying it's popcorn viewing for me, in a sense. You just grab a handful of them and gobble them down when you're not doing too much else and you don't want to think too hard about stuff. The series is available on DVD for an exorbitant price on Amazon, but I didn't acquire it by that means, if you know what I mean. And so I've just been quietly grokking that. So what other genre stuff? I did watch a 1972, I think it is, kind of soft, porny, very kind of eerie, 1974 it is, a 1974 vampire movie called Vampires with a Y, which doesn't star anybody that you know, and it's basically two women vampires in a country house seducing and chewing on men. I saw this ages ago when it first came out in the cinema, and to be honest with you, it hasn't got too much better since then. My perceptions have changed somewhat, and I need more than a bit of tits and ass to keep me engaged in a movie these days, though tits and ass itself is not a distraction, you know, like a bad thing in the movie, but it's still kind of style but no substance to it, which is disappointing. I picked up for like $10 on Blu-ray, so I haven't really spent too much money on it, and it fills out the collection in that side. I did watch a 1966 French Jess Franco movie starring Eddie Constantine, who played Lemmy Caution in Jean-Luc Godard's Alphaville. It's called Attack of the Robots, and it's kind of borderline science fiction, borderline crime, borderline wise guy, private eye kind of movie. It's in black and white, but it is a lot of fun. It's just got that groovy 1960s look about it. It's got a wisecracking protagonist. I watched it with the subtitles. And, it wasn't a waste of time at all. It was just a groovy little 1960s movie about mad scientists who are turning people into kind of brainwashed, mind-controlled morons, but only people with a certain blood type, which made a little bit of a variation there. It's not bad at all, and I kind of like Eddie Constantine. He's an American guy who went over during World War II and stayed in France and made a career as a wise guy, private eye actor. He was also a song and dance man as well. That was one of his other things that he did. There's a whole bunch of stuff. If you go onto a website called Paris Chanson, which is a streaming music website, there's a lot of Eddie Constantine singing songs on there. So that was enjoyable. I really did kind of have fun with that, and it was something that was, again, off my radar. But I dipped into it and had a bit of fun with it. For the radio gig in ABC Local Radio Darwin, a non-genre thing that Liz Travaskis and I did was The Adventures of Barry McKenzie, a good exploitation film starring Barry Humphries and Barry Crocker. It's kind of a Candide sort of thing with the innocent abroad, where an innocent Australian guy called Barry McKenzie, who's very fond of beer and very unsuccessful with women, travels to England, and basically the movie satirises a lot of stuff about English society and also about Australians who travel abroad. It's one of the classics of the genre, and Liz and I had a lot of fun with that one too. We're doing this thing with the radio gig now, which makes it even more interesting than it was before. The audience members, so people call in to the radio station and suggest a genre for the next movie that we're going to talk about. So the first one was Australian comedy, so we did The Adventures of Barry McKenzie. The one we're doing this coming Thursday is going to be spaghetti western, so we're doing The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. We thought we'd go at the high end of things. So Liz and I are going to be talking about The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly next time around on the ABC radio gig. And that's fun. It's nice for audience interaction too. Maybe I should do that for the podcast as well, or at least for Paleo Cinema, and get audience people to suggest a genre. Once this Patreon thing, all the obligations on that are fulfilled, maybe I should do that and have people suggest a genre for the next episode, and then go in with that. So that's a lot of fun, and it challenges me too, because Liz, while we're recording, will go, here's your genre, and I've immediately got to think of a movie in that genre about which we're going to talk next time around. So it keeps me on my toes there, and I don't know what's coming, which makes it even more interesting for me. So what else have I watched? I watched Transcendence, the Wally Pfister directed movie starring Johnny Depp and Rebecca Hall and Paul Bettany. It's kind of like a singularity sort of thing, where a computer scientist who's at the Alan Turing level of things gets slowly killed by an anti-tech terrorist group, and then has his mind uploaded into a quantum computer, and all shit happens after that. And the only problem with the movie is it cops out on the ending. It doesn't go the full singularity. Well, that's not the only problem with the movie. The other problem is that it's really slow and turgid and portentous and has no discernible sense of humour about it. And no, yeah, basically it's badly paced and really badly put together. And yes, you're probably going to see it, but you're probably not going to enjoy it that much, even though there is some nice CGI stuff in there, and there are some ideas behind it, but they don't follow through to the extent they really should with that one, which makes it a bit disappointing. Just like another science fiction movie I've seen recently, Under the Skin, starring Scarlett Johansson as an alien who travels around Scotland picking up guys in cars and absorbing them by mysterious means. And that one, it's kind of weird and not always in a terribly good sense. I think that Scarlett Johansson's pretty good in the movie, but really it's I'm not sure it's a missed opportunity. I think it's more a bit meh, which kind of is in itself a disappointment and really isn't the sort of thing you'd expect for somebody who's doing this enormous franchise at the moment, for her to do this small, relatively low-budget genre film by hidden camera filming guys she picks up in a white panel van. So, yeah, you can see that, you cannot see that. It does have a little bit of Scarlett Johansson nudity for those that are interested in that sort of thing, but I don't think it has much depth because the kind of viewpoint character is such an empty null that it doesn't really give you anything to latch on to. Let's see. And that's about it for the genre stuff I've been watching. Really, it's kind of been a little bit disappointing apart from the Eddie Constantine movie. But I'm hopeful. August will bring us Guardians of the Galaxy, so I'm going to get my full Marvel comic book geek on and see that one and have a great time with it, I assume. The more I see of it, the more I'm optimistic about it, and I'm really hoping that that's going to be a bit of fun for me. But, so what I'm going to do is take a break now. And when I get back, I'm going to go through and hit some of the high points of Australian science fiction movies. I may talk about Australian science fiction television a little bit too. In fact, I already have with Time Treks, if you kind of accept that a TV series filmed in Australia is an Australian TV series, which is a moot point. But anyway, I'm going to take a break, and when I get back, we're going to start onto that. So get your pens and paper out, and there'll be a few things in there that you may want to write down for future viewing.
They say the world don't have heroes anymore? Well, damn them, Max. You and me, we're going to give them back their heroes. Hi there. This is Roger Ward, Fifi for Mad Max. And you're listening to Martian Drive-In. Enjoy, babies.
Okay, on to Australian science fiction movies. Now, there are not immense amounts of them, to be honest with you. It's not a genre that Australia as a nation has really taken to in the sense of making a lot of films in that. Of course, the Matrix films were made here, and Mark Proyas made Dark City here and things like that, but they're not strictly speaking Australian films. But there are some, and they're worth checking out. A lot of them aren't very good, I'll be honest with you about that, but they're at least interesting more for the environment in which they were made than for the films themselves at times. Now, the first thing I can find with any kind of science fiction or supernatural theme, and I'm sure there were things before this, was in 1952, Chips Rafferty, the iconic Australian actor, made a film with an expatriate American screenwriter called Casey Robinson. At the time, the Australian government had really fucked up laws regarding making cinema. And I mean truly fucked up. Here's what they did. You weren't allowed in 1952 to make a movie that cost over £10,000. The reason was it was considered a non-essential industry, and as the country was getting back on its feet after the war, and there were still things to pay off even 7 years after the war ended, the government decided that cinema wasn't an essential industry, so 10,000 quid was the most you could spend on it. It was very short-sighted of them to do this, of course, because if you make a decent movie, the returns are immense, potentially, and, of course, even with the $10,000 budget, they did make about three times their money back with sales overseas. Now, the movie in question, is called The Phantom Stockman. It starred Chips Rafferty, Guy Dolman, who you might remember played Michael Caine's boss in the first three Harry Palmer films. And an Australian actress called Jeanette Elfiger changed her name to Victoria Shaw and made a few movies in America, one of which was a really nice little thriller called Edge of Eternity in 1959, which was also directed by Don Siegel, which is kind of cool. She was also in a few other films. She was in the Eddie Duchin story with Tyrone Power. She did The Crimson Kimono, which was directed by Sam Fuller. So she did pretty well and had a career in TV mostly all through the 1960s and well into the 1970s as well. Then she appeared in a science fiction film in 1973 that you might know called Westworld. She was the medieval queen in Westworld. So anyway, back to 1952. The movie basically is a Western transplanted into Australia. A woman running a cattle property out near Alice Springs is threatened by her neighbour, an evil property owner played by Guy Dolman in a very RAF pilot moustache. And her godfather comes along, and her godfather is basically a supernatural stockman or a supernatural hero called the Sundowner, played by Chips Rafferty, of course. And he has some mystical powers. He has a telepathic rapport with his Aboriginal mate, for instance, which helps him at one stage. And the film's not really known for anything else besides that one kind of science fictional supernatural element, apart from the fact that it's the only feature film that has a cameo from one of Australia's earliest and greatest Indigenous artists, Albert Namatjira. There's still a little bit of that paternalism there as far as the Indigenous people are concerned in this movie, but it treats them with a lot more respect and in a lot more complex way than a lot of other films, which, there's a long path into the way cinema handles Aboriginal themes in Australia, and this is very early on that path, but nonetheless, it's not as offensive as a lot of other films were and as it could have been.
I'm stopping here and I'm going to find out who murdered my father.
Now look, Kim, we've been through this a dozen times. Your father wasn't murdered. It was an accident. The police report said so.
The report was wrong.
Oh, listen, Kim.
I will not listen. You're just like everybody else. You won't believe anything I say. I know Dad was murdered. He was dragged to death off my horse with my saddle on it. The stirrup should have been mine, too. Girl stirrups that he could only just get his toe into.
Okay, so he changed the stirrups.
He did not. He'd have changed the saddle first.
Not necessarily.
When he left here, he was in such a hurry, he took my horse because it happened to be the only one saddled. And when he was found, the leathers had been lengthened, and men's stirrups put on them. New ones that someone had put there to make it look like an accident.
That's ridiculous. Why do you torture yourself? You know it was an accident.
But say you are right, Kim. There's still nothing you can do about it.
I've already done something, Frank. I've sent for Alchador, the Sundowner.
Kim, how do you get in touch with an Aboriginal legend? There's no such person as the Sundowner. He's a myth.
He is not, Frank. He was one of Dad's best friends. He's my godfather.
Well, even if he does exist, how do you find him? The blacks say he's 10 feet tall. They reckon it was him who stopped that tribal war up in the Pitjantjatjara country and found those explorers that were lost between Meekatharra and the Granites. They reckon he can speak the language of every tribe in the Northern Territory, and that the bush animals come to him when he calls.
That's just a legend, Frank. But the real Sundowner does exist.
Okay, so he exists. That still doesn't find him.
I'll find him. I talked with old Changador this afternoon. He's sending a message to him now.
In a sense, I suppose, the Phantom Stockman, which also was released in the United States under another name, Return of the Plainsman, in 1953. It's almost like it's a ancient Australian superhero in a sense. He's got supernatural powers. He rights wrongs and helps people out in the context of the Northern Territory as it was in the 1950s. But it's got just that little bit of science fictional stuff about it, and it's probably the first point that I can point to and say this is something with a theme that's genre-related in Australian cinema. Now, the movie, they Chips Rafferty sold the rights to the Americans for about £35,000. And so they made plenty of money on the film itself, and it was also released in the UK. So, and it did about, you know, $15,000 worth of business in Australia as well. £15,000, I keep saying dollars, but it's pounds, worth of business in Australia as well. And it's a hard movie to find. I've only found a converted VHS copy of it, but if you type in Return of the Plainsman, you may be able to find something. And if you're on various torrent sites, you may be able to find it as well. But I kind of like it because even though it's, in a sense, a converted Western, converted to Australian landscapes with Australian Indigenous people, it's still part of cinema history, and I find it interesting for that. So we've got to, from there, we've got to move on until roughly the 1970s. 1970 would be the next genuine genre film that appeared in Australia. There was an enormous hiatus between about 1958 and 1970, where Australians made no Indigenous, in the sense of being an Australian. They made no feature films at all. So we've got to go to 1970, when the laws changed, when the Australian Film Development Corporation was created and cinema production started up again. Around the time that The Phantom Stockmore was being made, an Italian man migrated to Melbourne from Italy, and his name was Giorgio Mangimelli. And Giorgio made some short films himself. He did a feature film called Clay about an escaped convict hiding out in an artist colony. He made a couple of short films in the early 60s called Spag and 99%, which have only just now been remastered and released by the Australian Film Institute. And Mangimelli then made a science fiction film, which very, very few people know about. And that science fiction film was called Beyond Reason. The only copy of Beyond Reason I've been able to find is a videotape tape transfer, which has time coding across the top of the screen. The story in Beyond Reason is there's a nuclear war starting, and the medical staff and inmates of a mental institution hide out in an underground bunker on the grounds of the mental institution. Now, it's got a great big blast door on it, and the blast door has a code on it, and it's designed as a basically a nuclear bomb shelter. So what occurs in this is that the one person who escapes to the shelter, who knows the code to get the door back open again, is traumatized and forgets the code. So there are a whole bunch of asylum inmates and a few staff members who are trapped down there. There's plenty of food, and there's even seems to be cigarettes and other supplies down there. They feel the blast. They hear someone pounding on the door, and the pounding eventually stops. And they're trapped down there, and things start getting a little bit heated and a little bit crazy and a little bit troubling for all, everyone concerned. Order starts breaking down there, of course, as it would under the circumstances. And things come to a head just as the woman remembers what the code is, and they all emerge into a blasted post-apocalyptic landscape of smashed up buildings and rubble and bricks and wooden things like that. And the movie comes to quite a depressing and dark climax. The movie's not very good. I mean, David Stratton in The Last New Wave, which is my Bible on this particular period of Australian cinema history, says that nothing about it is convincing, from the witless dialogue to the appallingly stilted acting in the tentative direction. It was distributed, and it appeared, had a release at Sydney's Regent Theatre in March 1971, supporting Jonathan Miller's disappointingly bland Hayley Mills comedy, Take a Girl Like You. So basically they had this quite amateurish but well-intended science fiction film about people trapped in a bunker after a nuclear war, and put it up against a very lame Hayley Mills light sex comedy from 1971. It's no wonder, based on those two things, that the film wasn't successful at all, and it's almost a lost film now. apart from the one videotape Academy ratio version of it that I was able to find on a torrent website. But nonetheless, it is an Australian science fiction film. It's it is a bit hard to watch because it is quite slow, and it was done on a minimal budget, really. They got in a whole bunch of people who aren't professional actors. There's a little bit of nudity in there, but it's not very titillating. And it's very earnest. I'll give it that. It is very earnest. But, yeah, nonetheless, it is an attempt at making a different kind of film than was being made in Australia at the time, where most of the films were by and about angry students, or they were period piece dramas, or they were about middle class concerns and things like that. So 1970, this was Giorgio Manganiello's Beyond Reason, which I didn't know. I mean, I've been studying Australian film since the 1970s, literally in a very haphazard and amateurish way, but I'd never heard of this film before about a month ago, which shows how obscure it is.
Our planet is completing its destructive cycle many years ago, by measurement. Prior to the destructive process commencing, we leave in this vehicle and come here in order to bring a message of goodwill and to pass on the warning. The germs of destruction can still be checked.
With Jesus, teeth. I don't know what you're talking about.
Can you repeat the information so far conveyed?
No!
Uh-oh. Shirley, you know they're here. We know they're here. But can you convince anyone else that they're here?
You scare the pants off us. You nearly kill me with that ray, and then you start playing God. Well, I mean, what do you want? Talk to the government. Don't talk to me, fascist. Fascist!
Forgive our directness. It seems essential to alert as quickly as possible.
Alert? You'll have people jumping off buildings if you go on this way. Well, you can't just whack them in the face with that light thing and hope it works. The whole country just stops. Strikes all over the world.
Surely we are aliens. We do not comprehend the ways of this place. Will you help us?
Why should I? Tragedy won't affect me. Won't even affect my kids.
Time is not involved, certainly, but the likelihood of correct combinations is always possible. There is a direct benefit for you, Sherry. We can demonstrate the power of pure thought.
Pure thought. Terrific.
Sherry, we're talking about power. We can give you power.
It's a deal.
Thank you.
That's from a 1972 film called Shirley Thompson vs. the Aliens, which was made by Jim Sharman, the guy who directed Rocky Horror Picture Show a few years later. Basically, the movie Shirley Thompson vs. the Aliens is an absurdist comedy. Jim Sharman was living in Surry Hills in Sydney and put up $17,000 of his own money to make a film about the banality of the Australian suburban existence and the repression of society and the kind of mediocrity of Australian society at the time. So he decided to set the movie in 1956, which was the time of the Melbourne Olympic Games. Duke of Edinburgh visited Australia, and there was a lot of flying saucer frenzy around the time. And it was also the start of rock and roll. So the story is basically Shirley, who is a widgie, and bodgies and widgies were kind of like the rock and rollers of Australia in the mid-late 1950s. So Shirley goes on a ride in Luna Park, the big amusement park on the shores of Sydney Harbour, which is still there. She goes on the River Caves ride, which I remember going on as a kid. You get in this little boat and there's a current that pushes you through all of these dioramas. It isn't a particularly scary ride, but it's a little bit of a journey you go on through the River Caves. And she meets aliens there, and the aliens warn her, as you heard, that Earth's bound for destruction if it keeps doing what it's doing, and that they're planning to invade, and they've taken over a bunch of people, including Prince Philip. So Shirley is probably the worst person to tell this to because she doesn't give a shit, really. She just wants to do what she wants. She's living with her mum and dad. They got her engaged to a real nerdy, unpleasant kind of guy that she doesn't particularly like. And she's not particularly bright. So Shirley's got this message from the aliens, kind of like Klaatu gave people in the day the Earth stood still. Imagine if they had given that message to basically a ditzy woman. Then that's pretty much the story of Shirley Thompson versus the aliens. I'm going to re-watch this film. I've seen some clips from it, which the National Film and Sound Archive have up on their website. But I'm going to re-watch this film now because I did Rocky Horror recently for the ABC radio gig, and so I've got an interest in the career of Jim Sharman there, who had a very interesting family. His father ran boxing tents, which was a kind of a weird thing. Country shows around Australia, there used to be boxing tents where the promoter, in this case Jimmy Sharman Sr., would have a whole bunch of professional boxers, most of which were Aboriginal guys. And for a pound or two, people could go into the ring and try to beat them. And if they won a bit of money. But these guys did it every day, whereas the people who bet and then go into the ring were usually just drunken pub brawlers. And they'd get the shit beaten out of them and lose their money. And that was what we knew as entertainment before television and the internet. So Jimmy Sharman came from that kind of showbiz career, showbiz family in a sense, and showman family, which does play into Rocky Horror and the way Rocky Horror was approached. But Shirley Thompson versus the Aliens was an early attempt at that. It combined science fiction with social commentary and absurdist comedy, and it's very much an artifact of the 1970s anti-establishment vibe that was around in the world, and particularly in Australia as well. So that's our second or third real science fiction movie made in Australia. It's a bit of fun. It's not to be taken seriously. Jane Hart, as the stage actress, plays Shirley and does a really nice job of it as well. And I kind of like it because it's nostalgia for things that were part of my childhood. That kind of stultifying suburban banality was very much the environment I grew up in to a big extent. And even if you don't have that background, even if you don't have that history, it's still a little bit of fun. And it kind of sits well with movies like Putney Swope, the Robert Downey Sr. film about the advertising business. And it's that protest against conformity, which powered a lot of cinema in the 1960s and the 1970s. And I like it. From what I remember of having seen it years ago, I like it. And I've seen three clips of it from the National Film and Sound Archive. And yes, it's a bit of fun. It's not to be taken seriously as science fiction at all, but it is interesting and a little bit groovy. Now we dive into the era that Mark Hartley has called Ausploitation. And Peter Weir's first feature film, The Cars That Ate Paris. Now, this is a severely fucked up film, but it's one that I'm incredibly fond of. I'll just get the précis for it, which came from the Australian Screen website. If you go to aso.gov.au, you get to the Australian Screen site, and it's got a lot of good information, a lot of clips about Australian films. So the synopsis here is, mild-mannered Arthur, played by Terry Camilleri, wakes up in a hospital in the quiet New South Wales country town of Paris in about 1950, after he and his brother have run off the road. The brother is dead. The mayor, played by John Mellion, takes Arthur under his wing, but Arthur senses that things are not right. The town's feral youth take over the streets at night in souped-up cars. The hospital is full of brain-damaged accident victims. Arthur discovers that he is not allowed to leave. And that's it. It's a very deeply disturbing and deeply weird movie with a great sense of dread and some really fine acting by people like John Mellion, who was an acting icon in Australia through the latter half of the 20th century. Terry Camilleri, who plays Arthur, very mild-mannered little actor. The only thing you might know him from is he played Napoleon Bonaparte in the first Bill and Ted movie. I think it was the first one. Yeah, it was the first one. So, there you go. But I'll play that, a little bit of the trailer from The Cars That Ate Paris. It's really weird, and it's almost started a subgenre of Australian car movies that went through movies like Mad Max. The Mad Max films, of course, are definitely car movies. F.J. Holden, Dead End Drive-In, Brian Trenchard Smith's Dead End Drive-In, and a bunch of other films were really kind of car-philic films, and The Cars That Ate Paris really started that, and kind of started that thin little subgenre of films that were in some way about, movies that were in some way about the Australian male's love of cars.
For our town, the light is at the end of the tunnel.
All over the world, accident. But that's the world we live in. It's the world of the motor car.
Listen to me. Now, you get this into your mind. Nobody leaves Paris. No one.
Well, we get far more opportunity to do experimental work in the field of surgery and psychiatry than your city expert. This is where the really exciting work is being done. As you know, I have two hobbies. The past, which is manifest in these lovely old country towns like Paris.
Neil, get off the road! Neil!
And the future, which lies with our youth.
I got this one. This one's mine. You nuts.
You irreligious bastard!
Daddy,
all right, come on, come on. Have you country boys forgotten the old school war cry? Have you? Have you forgotten the meaning of those words?
Woomera, woomera, babaloo, boomerang, crocodile, kookaburra, wombat, orangutan, wee-ho, way-ho, taramunga mine, quondong, billabong, gundabluey pine, platypus, emu, wallaby, roo, ivers, bulger, white cockatoo, harabara, cara, coal mine, fango, bogger mine, aramine, never try, yanka, hoopla, hoopla,
It's a deeply disturbing movie, as you can gather by that bit from the trailer. But I remember in my callow youth, my local shopping centre had one of the cars from The Cars That Ate Paris in it, and it was a VW Bug covered in big sheet metal spikes. They were angled pieces of sheet metal, and they wouldn't let anybody get near it because they were razor sharp as well. But it was very cool as a young teenager to see, A, a car that was in a movie in my local shopping centre, and B, such a bizarre car, which is kind of like a car version of the Australian spiny anteater, the echidna. It's painted silver. It was really a freaky thing, and it was incredibly popular with the local youth. So the movie, even though a lot of the satire went past me at the time, the movie I liked a lot when I was young because it was violent, it had cars in it, and basically it was violent and had a lot of cars in it. But it's Peter Weir's first movie. He went on to make a lot of fine films in his career as well. The main one that kind of covers genre stuff would be The Last Wave, the one with Richard Chamberlain in it, but which I really have to revisit. I haven't seen that since it first came out in the cinemas, so I think I'm going to have to find myself a copy of The Last Wave and rewatch it. I didn't appreciate it fully at the time, but I think that maybe being older and a little bit hopefully wiser, I might get more from it this time around. It does use a lot of Aboriginal motifs and Aboriginal stuff in it, and there is a big thing in Australian literature and in Australian science fiction literature at the moment to not appropriate Indigenous culture without fully understanding it and without the permission of the people who own the rights to those stories. And given that this movie, that movie was made a long time ago. I'm going to try to keep that in mind when I watch it. But there was at a Continuum, the recent National Science Fiction Convention, a talk by Amblin Quaymallina, one of the guests and an Indigenous writer, about appropriating Indigenous cultures into fiction and movies and stories and novels and things like that, which I found quite interesting and eye-opening. And so I'm a little bit wary of that stuff now. There are some guidelines available to people who want to use Indigenous themes and Indigenous stuff in their creative works, which don't seem to be restricted but seem to be respectful. And I kind of like that. So I'm going to have to watch The Last Wave with that in mind, I think, when I do see it. But Peter Weir went on to do a lot more mainstream movies. He also did the spooky but fairly dull Picnic at Hanging Rock. Gallipoli, he directed that, Year of Living Dangerously, with Mel Gibson and Linda Hunt in it, and Sigourney Weaver. Witness, The Mosquito Coast, Dead Poets Society, Green Card, Fearless, The Truman Show, Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World, and The Way Back. So, you know, he's had so far a fairly good career as a film director. But it didn't quite get back to the kind of earthy eeriness that you get from movies like The Cars That Ate Paris. Then we get into movies like Mad Max. Now, I was going to put in some audio from one of the Mad Max films into the podcast, but I think I've got a problem with that. I'm going to just double-check something. No, with Mad Max, I tried to get some audio off YouTube, but all of the audio on YouTube regarding Mad Max, with a couple of small exceptions, is the really shit version. Now, there is a shit version of Mad Max from 1979, and the shit version is the version where the American distributors redubbed the movie with American accents, which is dumb, of course, but it is also incredibly, incredibly, incredibly unnecessary. We both speak the same language. Americans and Australians speak more or less the same language, slightly different dialects, but fuck you, American distributors of Mad Max. I found some audio on the aso.gov.au website, so here is a little bit of audio from the first Mad Max film, which was filmed within about 10 or 15 kilometres of where I sit right now.
Mad Max, go ahead.
We are 100% snafu.
You okay?
Nothing the air in the tropics wouldn't fix.
Much damage?
You should see the damage, Bronze, huh?
Metal damage.
Brain damage, huh?
Are you listening, Bronze?
I am the Night Rider. I'm a fuel-injected suicide machine.
That was Mel Gibson, Steve Bisley, and Vincent Gill from the original Mad Max. And yes, there were the two sequels to Mad Max 2, Electric Boogaloo, and Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. And then, of course, there's that stupid Mad Max Fury Road coming up, which ruins the whole story because Mad Max is essentially an Australian film. And the second one was, and the third one was. There's a lot of Australian stuff in there. So, of course, they've got to film the new one with Tom Hardy in South Africa for some reason, because, yeah, South Africa, all in the Southern Hemisphere anyway, so we might as well film it over there. I think that was a very stupid thing to do. Now, the reasons given for filming Mad Max Fury Road in South Africa were that where George Miller wanted to film Mad Max Fury Road, in and around Broken Hill and Silverton, places I know quite well because Sal and I went on holidays there a year or two ago, were too green. They suddenly got a lot of rain. Everything went green, so they couldn't film there. Well, I've got some news for George Miller. There's a whole bunch of other Australia out there where you can film these things, which is not always green. You could go up to the Kimberley. You can go to the wheat belt of Western Australia. You can go to the Simpson Desert. You can go to the country outside Alice Springs. You can go to the Gulf Country of Queensland. Basically, there's a chunk of territory pretty much the size of Europe, which is dry and dusty enough to film a Mad Max movie. But for some reason, George Miller didn't want to do that. So fuck you, George Miller. The first three films are enjoyable, even though they start a racist. And they're great Australian stories. Now, there's a new movie, The Rover, came out. David Michaud's new movie, which stars Guy Pearce and Robert Pattinson, which has a little bit of a feel of Mad Max about it. It's kind of like society disintegrating and the impact of that kind of thing. I'm looking forward to seeing The Rover when I do get an opportunity, and that may be one to check out. But as far as Mad Max Fury Road is concerned, yeah, it's going to have car pranks. Yes, it's going to have angry things and ugly people and all sorts of stuff like that. But it's not going to be a proper Mad Max movie because it's set on the other side of the Indian Ocean. So fuck you, George Miller. And on that note, let's go to some more genre films from this part of the world. Brian Trenchard-Smith, a lovely guy apparently, a jobbing director, not always successful. He's no Orson Welles, but he's a good, honest action film entertaining director. He's still working. He did The Man from Hong Kong, which I talked about in a very early Paleo Cinema podcast. He did Death Cheaters and Stunt Rock and all of those kind of films. He did Turkey Shoot, which stars our friend of the podcast, Roger Ward, and Michael Craig, Carmen Duncan, a bunch of other people. Steve Railsback's in it, Olivia Hussey. Really interesting film, which I just watched. I just watched Turkey Shoot. I was going to do it for the podcast, but I thought, no, I'm going to take things a little more broad. But Turkey Shoot, which was known in England and became very successful in England because of its title, was known as Death Camp Thatcher because the guy in charge of its name was Thatcher. And this came out in England during Margaret Thatcher's regime. And because it was called Death Camp Thatcher, they really took to it in a big way. And the movie became incredibly successful there. What the fuck? I'm going to talk about Turkish Shoot a little bit. Basically, it's a prison camp where a prisoner, played by Steve Railsback, is incarcerated with a bunch of other people, including Linda Stoner and Olivia Hussey. And the prison camp commandant Thatcher, played by Michael Craig, an English actor who became an Australian and went on to have a late career here in Australia, who organises basically most dangerous game kind of hunts for political prisoners. It's set in a very dystopian future where controlling the population is a big issue. It's a little bit like things have been in Australia since September last year, only with death camps. Well, we still have them, but we only put refugees in them at the moment. But and Turkey Shoot is a lot of fun. Roger Ward's in there as a prison guard. He's got an enormous mustache. He's got a shaved head. First thing he does in the film is beat up a small woman, beat her to death just to prove a point, which isn't something that I recommend in cinema and isn't something I recommend in real life. But in the context of a 1986 action flick, is something that occurred there. It's got some gratuitous in the shower nudity in it. Apparently Steve Railsback was a pain in the ass to work with in the film. And Olivia Hussey was scared of all of the indigenous insect and animal population. But for some reason, and the movie's budget got slashed to the bone just before production started, so there were a lot of things that they couldn't do that they wanted to. And it was a bit of a nightmare shoot for everybody involved, but nonetheless, it made a very entertaining movie. I'll just play a bit of the trailer from Turkey Shoot because I think this is one where you want to sit back with some snack foods and maybe a couple of drinkies and just enjoy the silliness that was 1980s cinema.
It is 1995.
Open season!
Hunting is the national sport, and people are the prey. The world is ruled by a strict regime.
They're going to make obedient little citizens out of us.
Who are?
Society.
What do you mean?
Step out of line, and they take you to the funny farm. You could die laughing.
All you have to do is lead my guests on a chase for one day. A little sport.
You're going to kill us?
Not necessarily. You might survive.
Is everybody ready?
Come on, you big piece of shit.
You come with me.
I'm the one you can't break. I'm what you've been afraid of all your life.
I'm afraid of nothing.
You're afraid of failing.
Now, my little flower. Yes, I'm going to taste your honey.
It is less the size of one's gun that counts, or the skill with which it's used.
Don't you kill him, Jennifer. He's my target. This is Thatcher. The hunt is over. Shoot on sight, shoot to kill.
No way.
Quick, please take me with you. Don't leave me here.
The hunters and the hunted. The quick and the dead.
Oh, shit! Oh.
Who will survive the blood and thunder shocker of the year?
Now, you can just tell that's going to be fun. You got Roger Ward wading through a swamp with a machete in one hand and a pistol in the other. You've got explosions, you've got jet fighters, you've got women on horseback with crossbows. You've got everything you possibly need. You've got character actors. You've got Gus Mercurio, you've got Roger, of course. You've got... it's just a lot of fun, that movie. I really had fun watching it again today, even though it was a nightmare to make, as I said. It really is a lot of fun, and it's definitely one to treasure and occasionally enjoy. It's a kind of early equivalent, with a bigger budget, of the Asylum films. They're all not very good, but they're always a lot of fun. So moving on from that, I've got another Brian Trenchard Smith, which I'm going to check out again for the first time in a while, sometime this week, and that is Dead End Driving. Classic film. All the dissident young people are basically put in a prison camp in a drive-in, and the plan is to escape.
Here now the news for July 4th, 1995. In the wake of widespread economic collapse, officials are reporting massive general strikes.
In the 1970s, there was Clockwork Orange. Then in the 1980s came Mad Max and The Road Warrior. Now comes a startling new vision that takes you into the apocalypse and beyond. Back to the old drive-in you used to know and love. Only now, when the show is over, there is no way out. Dead End Drive-In.
Right now.
Not getting through to you, am I, son? No cabs, no buses, no transport. So, you're here. Government decides what to do with you. Government. This is your home.
You can't tell me they don't want to get out. Now.
Yeah, but they know they can't, son. There's no future. No future.
Come with me.
Jimmy, can't you see?
Ready.
This is all
we'll
we've got.
All get out of here, and don't you try and stop me again.
Now get out of the way! Hey!
Welcome to your future, like it or not. Dead End Drive-In.
So both of those films, Turkey Shoot and Dead End Driving, are set in 1995, which raises the possibility that they're in the same universe. Now, whether they are or not, purely speculative, and nobody's ever going to give us a definitive answer, but I'll put this out there. Here's something for you. If I get two people doing $1 subscriptions to the Patreon campaign at patreon.com/paleocinema, specifically asking me to review Dead End Drive-In and Turkey Shoot, I will do it. So it's just something to put out there, and I don't want people who've already donated doing this. I want some more people to put their money up, and I will get a guest in, and I will review Turkey Shoot and Dead End Drive-In after I do the great, big, enormous, and ugly Star Wars special next time around. How's that for you? I'm just throwing it out there. It may not float. It may float. It just depends. But I'm going to leave everybody with one more film, which I know is a great favorite of my old pal, Danny Oz. He likes it a lot. We have friends who worked on it and created the monster at the end of the movie. And it is atrociously bad in a very specifically 1980s kind of way.
This story is set in the future. The world is split into trading blocks, and the South Pacific is a nuclear-free zone. The fascist government plans to break the anti-nuclear treaty by permitting a nuclear submarine to enter the harbor. These are heavy times. One man threatens the government scam, Black Alice.
Man is a rebel, and rebels must be destroyed.
He's a dangerous man with a quest for peace.
I'm not as dangerous as that sub out there in the harbour with 5 million innocent people living around it. You dig?
They trap him. They zap him. But he's released from his hologram prison 115 years into a post-apocalyptic future.
What's going on here?
There are monsters. Freaks. Can he survive?
You've got to get back. Change time.
He's got to get back to the present. It's in the script.
You'll appear at exactly the same time you left. You will have only 1 hour before the accident.
Let there be lights. Let there be camera. Let there be music.
Call out the instigator. Cause there's something in the air.
Let there be action. Blows your socks off! Sons of Steel.
Now with every heartbeat, feel the tension mount.
Coming to you soon in Meltdown Vision.
Over there, Steve, in it.
Yep, if you haven't seen Sons of Steel from 1988/89, depending on who you use as a reference, definitely do. It's got a time-traveling, really ugly protagonist who's also a rock and roll singer. It's got a monster with a giant dick. It's got nuclear submarines in Sydney Harbour. It's got time travel to a post-apocalyptic future. It's got basically everything. It's one of those movies that's way too ambitious and way too crazy for its own good, and yet people love it. Apparently it's got a really big cult following in Hungary, of all places. But yeah, Sons of Steel is a hell of a lot of fun. And I did first see it on VHS back in the day, and the VHS tapes are going for a large amount of money these days, but it's really worth seeing. It's one of those movies, like a lot of Australian genre films at the time, that was made on a crazy small budget with a lot of goodwill from people, and it really does kind of work in its own way. It's not, the plot isn't fantastically well held together. Rob Hartley, the protagonist, Black Alice, isn't the most nuanced actor you're ever going to see in a film, but it does have that kind of 80s rock and roll vitality that a lot of other films have of the era, and it's, quite unlike any other Australian film that I know of, and that's not a bad thing at all. I think originality, if particularly when you're in a genre that doesn't get a lot of love from a lot of people, as genre films didn't at the time. This is way before they started outgrossing every other kind of film on the planet. 88, everyone thought that, again, that science fiction cinema meant Star Wars and Star Wars-like things. And there were these other people who were kind of getting into a punk and proto-cyberpunk look. And I think very much that Sons of Steel is kind of proto-cyberpunky in a way. And it's a, as I said, it's a lot of fun. Having looked through these films and written up about them for the notes for this podcast, I really do have to revisit a lot of them. I think that Australian science fiction films in particular, not just Ausploitation, because there are a lot of Ausploitation films that aren't genre works, but the Australian Ausploitation genre films, even things like Patrick, which I haven't mentioned, and which is remade recently, and a bunch of other films like that, are really vital. They've got a wildness and an originality, and they're made by people who maybe don't have the training and the experience of a lot of American and English and other places, movie makers. But the thing is that all movies that you see, to a certain extent, I've said this before, are successful because the people who made them got to the point when they where they finished the film. So they've successfully made a movie. And a lot of these films, even though they're flawed, have a lot of originality, they're a lot of fun, and they're a bit unlike anything else you're going to see, which I think is the main thing that pisses me off about Mad Max Fury Road, that you lose a certain Australianness about it by doing it overseas. You lose that kind of larrikin sense of fun and anti-authoritarianism that comes naturally from Australian actors and Australian directors, Australian writers and those sorts of things. But anyway, I'm going to wrap up there. There's a lot more I could say about Australian genre films. I haven't even talked about fantasy movies and horror films yet, and that's another thing that I could spend 12 hours podcasting about at some stage in the future, and I may well do. But just remember, if you want me to review Turkey Shoot and Dead End Drive-In, I want two people to donate a monthly subscription of $1, specifically asking for me to review those two films. And I don't want it to be people who have already subscribed. But anyway, I'm going to wrap it up there, and I've got to do the credits because everybody who donates to the Patreon campaign gets a movie credit. I would like to thank Alyssa, our location scout, Tansy, our Foley artist, Miss Jane, our wardrobe mistress, who's given way beyond what she should have, Christopher M, who's our gaffer, Chris M, who's our camera operator, Julia, who's our casting director, Jan, who's our dialect coach, Gary, the property master, Morris, the musical director, and a new one, Armin, who is our key grip. Thank you all for that, and even if you don't donate or can't donate for whatever reason, I'm glad you're enjoying and listening to the podcast, and I'll be back in 2 weeks with the mega grand sale Star Wars special that I stupidly committed myself to. So in the meantime, enjoy your movie watching, look after yourselves, love the people you're with, and keep watching the skies. And I'll be back soon.